Make them sit at the front. Okay. So, yeah, sure. Do. Who knows if anybody else can come. There's nobody online yet. Apparently. So I can't find out if the microphone's working correctly. We will have to assume that it is. Right. Do you have any questions about Moll Flanders' life of the universe? Especially Moll Flanders. We will talk about this. We will spend quite a lot of time talking about this. Of escaping. At the end. But how would she be punished at the end? Oh, right, okay, right. So, there are two moments of penitence. We will talk about this. No questions otherwise? We will talk about this now. Okay. Most of the class will be answering those two questions. So, let us start. This is all for the next class. Okay, so, what aspects of Defoe's life can we link to the model? To the novel. Not the model. There is no model. The novel. What aspects of Defoe's life can we link to the novel? His morality. What do you know about his morality? Okay, more or less, right? Interesting. Okay, we'll explore that. Anything else? Anything more specific? Who was that? Right, so it's a non-conformist or dissenter, but you can't choose. Not both, yes. A non-dissenter is a bishop or something. Yeah. Okay, so he was a non-conformist. Is that relevant? Is that relevant? Right. Okay. Hello. Before you sit, if you grab the list, so you don't have to. Right. Is that comparable to Moll Flanders' business? Why did he have business failures? Do you have any idea? Was he bad at business? Right, you could argue that as part of doing business. He started with quite a stable tile business. When he got married, his father-in-law encouraged him to go into international trade. And he went into international trade just before the Napoleonic Wars started. And that was one of the main reasons for his business failure. He also, I think, in the sense that, for example, one of the ships he had invested in was captured by French pirates. It's questionable how guilty he was about that. I mean, again, one of his good ideas was to buy 40 civet cats, because they were used on the continent to produce perfume. I won't go into the details, but it involves a gland in their anus, basically. But anyway, and those were actually confiscated for his debts. So, how is any of that relevant to the novel? Okay. Right. Well, one of his businesses, encouraged by his father-in-law, was importing tobacco from America. And there is a moment where Moll is doing that, and part of the cargo is ruined, etc., etc. Defoe, because of all of these things, to some extent, squandered his wife's dowry. So he married the daughter of quite an affluent tradesman, and he lost all of this money, which he very much sort of blamed himself for. She was very, very supportive of him in all of his different problems. So we might want to see aspects of the gentleman trader in him. But it is very different in the sense that the gentleman trader wants to live like an aristocrat, and that's how he spends all of Moll's money, whereas Daniel Defoe was trying to have a business and was working, etc. And by the very nature of the fact that he was working, he was not actually seeing himself as a gentleman, because the two things are incompatible. As a result of that situation, he went to debtor's prison, which it was ridiculous in the sense that if somebody is in prison for their debts, it's very difficult for them to pay off their debts, if you know what I mean. But it's not particularly traumatic. If you read Little Dorrit, or if you see a film of Little Dorrit by Dickens, you get some idea of what a debtor's prison was like. It's not too bad, if you like. People could even spend time with their families in debtor's prison, etc., etc. However, I mean, you said her materialistic mindset. I imagine that a lot of the people below the gentry, the business people who are getting their hands dirty, and the working class in London had quite a materialistic attitude in general by that stage. But I would say that the feeling of constant financial anxiety and fear of poverty that pervades North Flanders probably comes from that. Anything else in his life which might be relevant? I will ask and answer my own questions. He was sent to Newgate Prison, as well as being pilloried for 3 days, because he was accused of sedition. Basically, in the shortest way with dissenters, he suggested that the compromise that most dissenters had reached with the Anglican Church was excessive. And so the Anglican Church, as part of the state, sort of punished him for this. So, I mean, sedition is really not a very, I mean, it sounds much more serious than it really was. He was criticizing the attitude of part of the nonconformist church, which, you know, you would not tend to go to prison for. But he was sent to Newgate for that, which was pretty horrible. And Newgate was pretty horrible. So he has some direct experience of that. Okay. But it's not something where we can really say he has taken a large part of his life experiences and fictionalized it, as sometimes happens with novels. Okay, I'll ask a different question. What filters do objective is the subject. Objective reality. What filters does objective reality go through in the novel? So, if we accept the fiction of the novel, what is there between the events that are told and us reading about the events? Is there anything in between? There's a narrator. Good. Anything else? Yeah. Right. So that's your narrator. Good. Yes. I accept your narrator. One narrator. Any other filters? Is it just the only filter of the narrator? I'll give you a clue. There are three filters. No? Okay, so narrator, very good. But what we have first is we have young Moll's subjective experience of the events. Because it's a first-person narrative, yeah, the narrative is necessarily unreliable, yeah, because it's subjective. You're just seeing one person's one view, not what actually happened. Okay, that is then reinterpreted by Old Moll. So we have a woman at the end of her life reinterpreting the events of her life from the point of view of where she is. Then we have your narrator coming in and cleaning that up to some extent and making it supposedly into something which is more morally instructive. And then outside that, outside the whole process of the novel, we have Daniel Defoe as an authorial voice, or as an author, controlling everything. Right? So, our process in terms of trying to understand this novel and what's happening in this novel requires us to separate young Moll from old Moll, from the fictional narrator and the author in his intentions in this case. So that's quite a big ask. Yeah? That's quite a tall order. And what we're being expected to do. And we probably should be tentative about our conclusions about Defoe's objectives, reality, what Moll is really experienced, what Moll is trying to manipulate us into thinking, and what the narrator is trying to manipulate us into thinking. And all of those are going to affect the two questions you asked at the beginning. Whether I thought her repentance was real and what did you ask? And about, yeah, whether the morality holds true. Okay. So what do we know about Daniel Defoe, the real author, the person who lived, in London and sometimes Edinburgh? What do we know about his views, the way he saw the world? Yay, we have a visitor. Hello, Manuel. Can you hear me okay? Maybe not. Can you hear me, Manuel? He's gone to get coffee or something. Okay, that we will see. Right. So, I hope you can hear me. Somehow. Okay, so the big thing that we're told, and the first thing they tell you in most critical sources about, and textbooks and things like that, about Daniel Defoe is he was a Puritan, yeah? He was a nonconformist, he was a dissenter, blah, 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 right? And that can actually be quite problematic, because we're going to think, that instantly makes us think of some sort of dour Calvinist, so one of these sort of, somebody like Brocklehurst in Jane Eyre, which you haven't read yet, but the sort of, you know, somebody dressed in very dark clothes, very serious, no sense of humour, etc., etc. Or even perhaps somebody like Milton, And Milton was not a particularly standard Puritan, because he didn't believe in literalism of the Bible. None of that, I think, is actually that helpful in terms of understanding Defoe, because we're understanding somebody whose life is much more dominated about business and working in the city and being a spy and his day-to-day activities than his religion. His religion is hugely important. The fact that he was a dissenter is hugely important, but it's hugely important because he was an outsider. Okay? Remember that. People who were not members of the Church of England, who had not conformed, were not allowed to do certain series of jobs, etc., etc., etc. And a lot of people were likely to see them as sort of crazy Bible bashers, basically. This is not the same time of enthusiasm that we have during the interregnum or even during Milton's life. A Puritan or a nonconformist like Defoe is actually much closer to the nonconformists in terms of mentality who were around Mary Wollstonecraft. Who's she? Who's Mary Wollstonecraft? A writer, woman, singular, yes. And the mother of Mary Shelley, etc., etc. So, there is an important tendency after the interregnum for nonconformists to be, to some extent, what we would call today socialist, left-wing, progressive, etc., etc. Whereas, of course, if we're thinking of crazy American Puritans, they're much more likely to be very right-wing, etc., etc., and more dogmatic. So, it's better to understand when we talk about, I mean, it's true that he probably would have defined himself as a Puritan. That was his family's religion, etc. But that is much more important as being an outsider and having a social conscience and believing in social justice rather than somebody who is being very sort of moralistic and wanted to go to church every Sunday and wear uncomfortable clothes and that sort of thing. Okay. So, bear that in mind in relation to the question of his religion. Okay. How was Defoe, yes, what was Defoe's relationship with his literary contemporaries? Can you identify any of these people? Can you see that one? Not very well. Anyway, this one in the middle is R. Daniel with a very big wig. This is Swift. This is Pope. And this, I think, is probably Pope again, but I'm not sure. Anyway. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they tended to be very nasty about him, insulting his intelligence. Joseph Addison, for example, even though Joseph Addison was a Whig, like Defoe, described him as a false, shuffling, prevaricating rascal. But Defoe, I mean, occasionally sort of criticized other writers, but I mean, he was very admiring, actually, of Steele. It tended to be more against him than towards him. Some of these people were not very nice. An important idea that we ought to bear in mind is his understanding of natural law. Natural law is an idea that, it goes back to Thomas Aquinas and people like that, but in a sort of Protestant-y context, we would probably relate it to Hugo Grotius. Any idea who Grotius is? Grotius. Grotius was a Dutch sort of legal expert and was a friend of John Milton's. And he, and then later Samuel von Pufendorf, basically developed this idea of natural justice, which was the idea that there are sort of certain human values that go beyond particular cultures. and that it's wrong to be imposing Christian values on, I mean, you know, this is an age where they're coming across all sorts of other societies. And the idea that you're going to judge another society in terms of sort of, you know, Christian values that have grown up in Europe is probably not a very good idea. And Defoe sort of takes this idea and applies it to a large extent to the poor as well. So this idea that the poor should not be judged in the same way that you judge the people who are comfortable, who are well off, the gentry, etc., largely philosophically can be related to that. And basically what he believed, what he argued, was that there is, in fact, what comes from Grotius, is there is a concept of self-preservation. So the first natural law is that you want to preserve yourself from death, which is pretty reasonable, really. But the way that Defoe understood that was that self-preservation takes precedence over parental love, and it takes precedence over robbing people, stealing from people, if they're richer than you. It does not justify stealing people who are also poor or who are poorer than you, but it does in that type of situation. So, I mean, to some extent, a lot of those ideas have actually been incorporated into a lot of the way that modern Western laws work. I mean, there is a sort of idea that, you know, if people steal for because they need food or whatever, the legal system treats them in a much more benevolent way than if they do it because they want to have more, sort of thing. And I mean, so we can see an illustration of directly from Defoe's writing in terms of that sort of attitude. In, at one point, I can't remember where, so in one of his pamphlets, he said that the worst pirates are more honest than capitalist speculators behind the pyramid scheme known as the South Sea Bubble. Do you know what the South Sea Bubble was? Right. Spain basically said nobody else can trade with Spanish America, especially during the period when Spain was occupying Portugal. But there was quite a lot of pressure from other countries to allow trade with Latin America, with South America. And so at the beginning of the 18th century, the Spanish government decided that it was going to grant privileges for companies, for a monopoly company to control all of the trade between, for example, Britain and Latin America. And that would be controlled by that company and by Spain through that company. And so it was, they constituted what was called the South Sea Company. South Sea because Latin America is in the South Hemisphere. I mean, it's not very accurate, but you know what I mean. That's why it's called the South Sea Company. And there was this idea that everybody knew that loads of gold and loads of silver had come out of Latin America and that there were presumably loads of resources there. And this company was going to be in charge of all of the trade between this place, which was full of resources, and Britain, which was very good at trading things. And so this company, before it even started doing anything, its shares began to inflate in value. And this was to a large extent promoted by several members of the government. You will not believe that there could be a situation where members of the government use their position, their privileged position for their own economic benefit. It's very surprising that this happens, but this happened. And then in about 1722, I think it was, the whole thing collapsed. So, I mean, have you heard of tulipomania? It's the same sort of thing. We never seem to learn because there are all sorts of examples like this until, you know, the 21st century. But it was along those sorts of lines. And you had a lot of people who were very powerful and sort of with insight and information who managed to make a lot of money and escape, and a lot of people who had much less money who invested in it, like, for example, John Gay, who wrote The Beggar's Opera, who lost everything. So, again, I think most of us would see as very reasonable. It's not the same somebody who is stealing because they need food to somebody who is becoming immensely rich out of a pyramid scheme like this. The two things are not equivalent. And of course, at this time, in the early 18th century, people who stole a loaf of bread could get executed or sent to Australia. I don't know which is worse. Not Australia, not yet, sorry, get sent to America. Whereas, you know, nobody who was actually benefited or had insider information from the South Sea Bubble, as it was called, got punished at all. So there's that sort of mindset, which is, as I say, much more about social justice than it is about actual puritanism in whatever sense we mean by that. And of course, somebody like Defoe would never be in the position of being a minister. I mean, even though, you know, he's got all of these languages, very, very well educated in terms of, you know, what he's read, what he understands, etc., what he's able to, his analysis of politics, hugely energetic person, but he would never be a government minister because he's excluded, because he's a non-performer. So you can see how the two things relate in terms of his sort of hatred of the powerful, in that sense. Similarly, he recognized that women were at a disadvantage in a man's world. I mean, he wouldn't have used the word patriarchy, but he was able to see this. And so, for example, he said that the person who was primarily responsible for a woman's decline into prostitution, the man who seduced her, was much more culpable for that prostitution than she was. Radical ideas, of course. But at the time, I mean, this is quite forward thinking, if you like. And similarly, he had a specific attitude towards transportation, which was? Yeah, but what did he think it was a terrible thing to do to people? Yeah, I mean, he wasn't transported, but yes. So his son emigrated to America, one of his sons. But that is the point. I mean, most people who were not, before 1720, most people who were condemned for pretty much anything, I mean, like stealing a bit of cloth, and I mean, there was a famous case at the beginning of the 19th century of a 12-year-old who was executed for stealing a loaf of bread. I mean, it's crazy laws. I mean, you know, we love to criticize Sharia law, but, you know, it was as brutal as that. As an alternative to that, being sent to the colonies, which often meant that you were a sort of slave, as you said, a peon, you were in peonage, for 7 years or 14 years. Again, I don't know why those are the two categories, but they are. Or you could just go sort of for free and you would not be allowed back in a certain period. If I remember correctly, the period was 7 years and 14 years in terms of coming back. Of course, we know of lots of cases of people who come back early and things like that and don't stay there. But there is much more of a possibility that the Americas can offer you a second chance than if you're executed. Obviously, you don't get a second chance if you're executed. So as that alternative, and I think there's some reality and some romanticization of the Americas as a more equal society in Defoe's mind as well. So there's a lot of those ideas in the background, and they are going to inform to a significant extent what we see in this story. What can we say about the fictional narrator? How is the fictional narrator presented?
He is, as you said, the world, he is a mirror of yours, that is just important.
Right, okay, so the two voices, as we've said, are not well separated, but you can actually work out basically which is which. He tends to talk in quite a masculine and authoritative tone. He doesn't use the pronoun I generally. Whereas she speaks in a much more sort of vivacious way. At the same time, the narrator is being presented as somebody who's really quite obtuse. He's not very clever, and he doesn't seem to be able to see the contradictions in what Moll is saying. So, for example, he says that he's basically cleaned up the text a little bit because it was a little bit too scandalous. But the text is still was written more like one still in Newgate than one grown penitent and humble, as she afterwards pretends to be. And pretends could have all sorts of nuanced meanings at this time, and it's not very clear what's being suggested there. It could be more or less finchir, like it does in modern English, but it could also mean sort of intentar in sort of pretender sense. So that's a very ambiguous word, and that sort of is, I think, intentionally used there by Defoe to suggest that the level of the sincerity of Moll's repentance is at least questionable. Yes. Good. Thank you. Well done. Okay, one point. I was going to ask that later. So we have that sort of Chaucerian narrator who is a little bit more stupid than the people he's talking to, and we are being encouraged to read between the lines there. Good. To some extent, yes.
It's decent, so
yeah, I mean, he could easily have cleaned it up a lot more, and he could have put much more emphasis on that narratorial voice. But I think there's an element of him actually enjoying some of the precedents that there isn't, being ironic about some of the precedents that we find in the literature at the time. And so, I mean, again, we have this situation where the narrator says that superlative villains on stage in the end are either executed or penitent. But of course, he ends up presenting somebody who's apparently not particularly penitent and is not executed. So he's sort of contradicting himself in terms of that. I think we can conclude that the moralizing voice is pretty artless. It's not very well constructed. And it's where it inserts itself into the text. But his abstract assertions add nothing really of any value. And you could do this once sort of by mistake. I think the fact that it happens repeatedly, a little bit like the chorus in Henry V, shows that there's intentionality in this, in the sense that some of the moral lessons that he's extracting from the text, they're not there. What are you talking about? So the author, again, is continually, sorry, not the author, the narrator, working on this last night and I haven't corrected it properly. The narrator is continually undercut. No, I'm just reading it wrong. Sorry. The author continually undercuts the value of the narrator's abstract assertions, which are soon drowned out by the warmly involved feminine voice of Moll herself. Okay, so it would seem that Defoe, the author, is intentionally presenting this moralistic idea and ridiculing it by having this filter through which the text comes. How does old Moll fashion her story? So we've said we've got the authorial filter, we've got the narratorial filter, the narrator. What about old Moll? Is she reliable or unreliable?
She would have researched the things she's not
Okay, fair enough. But she's now repented. Okay, so we can say that, like the narrator to some extent, who's pretty unreliable because he doesn't really know what he's talking about, she is unreliable because she has a she has an objective. I mean, she's not just telling us the story because we might be interested. She's trying to convince us of what has happened, and she's trying to convert biography or autobiography into spiritual biography, and it's a story of sin and repentance. However, what we tend to get from her is a process of confession, and we might say the whole concept of confession as a Catholic concept is not something that Defoe is likely to be particularly impressed by, and then justification. So, I mean, you know, if you think about dealing with children, if a child confesses to something and then gives you 100 reasons why, they haven't really gone through the proper process of actually feeling bad about it. They're still justifying it to themselves or to others. And Moll's actions can always be excused by necessity, by fear of poverty, or by temptation of the devil. The only really supernatural element in the whole story, which makes it radically different from most of what's come before, is this devil who tempts her. And the devil who tempts her is just the opportunity presented itself. It's rather convenient to see it in terms of the devil. So when, for example, Moll robs a child, she presents this as reproof for the parents' negligence. And she's almost doing a favor to the parents by showing them they shouldn't be so negligent. So what we can say is that Moll, if you like, takes the Grotian concept of necessity or self-preservation and reinterprets it as the demands of her ambition to become a lady of means. Yeah. She decides as a child she wants to be a lady of means. She, at the end of her life, is a lady of means. That is the process that she is understanding. That is the meaning of her life, that process. And anything that helped her on that process is justified because it was necessary. It wasn't really necessary in the sense that Grotius meant self-preservation, but from her perspective, it was necessary. And it's true that Moll, but we don't see Moll gratuitously harming anybody. She just takes what she needs from people. But that's because she needs it, because she has to become a lady. So that is her process, if you like. Old Moll argues that she was motivated by fear of poverty, but the truth is that she never descends to missing a meal. We never have a situation where she goes hungry, let alone facing actual starvation. Yeah, the fear of poverty is a very sort of abstract thing, not so much of a real thing. Her real fear, which is nearly hysterical about this, is her fear of going into service. Yeah, she does not want to be a servant. That would be absolutely death for her. And we can understand this. I mean, this is an understandable emotion, if you like, but it is not natural law. It is not self-preservation. The choice between, you know, potentially risking death and self-preservation is one thing. The choice between having to work as a servant and robbing is a completely different thing. They're not moral equivalents. Okay. Thus, a supposed repentant confession becomes an amazingly self-confident appeal for sympathy. She is trying to convince us that her final situation of being a lady is justified, that she has behaved in a way that may not be the most commendable, but is not characterized by gross immorality. So incongruously, the supposed penitent takes great delight in recounting her criminal adventures. Old Moll's analysis is consistently tendentious and contradictory. So, for example, one of the important ideas here, and Defoe is almost sort of a little bit playing with his own belief systems from what we know from the other writings. She blames her criminal career on the non-existence of a French-style orphanage system. So in France, when somebody is condemned to prison, or when somebody is executed, or when somebody is sent to French colonies, or whatever happens, the children are taken away, they're put into an orphanage, they are educated, they're well fed, they're taught a trade, and then they're let out onto the world when they're 18, as we understand orphanages. The modern concept of orphanages was invented in France. And there isn't a similar state orphanage system in place in Britain. And so Moll argues to us that she wouldn't have become a criminal if she had gone, if there had been a nice French system of orphanages. Yeah? Fair enough, no? No? Is that fair or not? Do you agree with her? Okay, but we have a situation where in a more chaotic, less structured system, she is taken in by her nurse, she's fed, she's taught things, etc., etc. She's then taken in by the cultural store authorities, the cultural store lady, she's placed in a family, she's basically taught all sorts of accomplishments, actually many more things than she would be in an orphanage, and then she was placed into the world. She's in, actually in a better position to take up a job like a lady's companion, like a governess, or like a servant, than she would be if she'd been to a French orphanage. It's not a structuralist system, but it is actually a system that has placed her in the same sort of, in a better place than she would be through that. The French orphanage system in terms of girls, basically prepared people to be servants. She chooses not to be a servant. So the French orphanage system would not have helped her. Yeah, but it's a plan for making orphans, working class, or poor children servants. Yeah, she doesn't want to be a servant. So if she comes out at 18 or 16 or whenever it would be of the orphanage system in France, educated to be a servant, with her mentality, if we accept her identity as given, that's not a possibility. That's not going to be something that she would accept. So it's actually a false argument she's giving us. And the novel presents a series of episodes in which the narrator's expression of guilt and repentance is not fully compatible with her behaviour at the time. Cumulatively, we see the subtle mismatch between the narrative of evolution towards penitence that Moll recounts and objective interpretation of events. So, again, we are told that she has this moral horror of incest, although perhaps slightly not completely understanding the concept of incest, because her first horror of incest comes from the fact that of marrying the brother of the person who seduced her, which isn't really incest, and it may not be ideal, but it's not incest, but she understands that as incest. But she, again, she says that she was nauseous, the most nauseous thing in the world when she finds out that she has married her half-brother in America, yeah? But she carries on happily living with him for 3 years, and the fact that the revelation that he is her half-brother comes out in an argument. Not that she sort of basically says, look, we have to talk about this, we can't go on like this because I'm your half-sister. She has an argument with him, the information is divulged, and then as an old woman, she interprets this as the situation being unacceptable. But we can imagine a situation where if that argument hadn't happened, she would have happily continued on living. I mean, it's an honest mistake, if you like, living with this man married in the Americas. So that is, we can see very clearly there, that is a reinterpretation from her old age, putting her in the best possible light of something which actually did not happen in that way. And we have that pretty consistently throughout the novel. So old Moll presents her younger self as an innocent who is frank, unafraid, charming, breathless. So we have this idea of sort of an energetic, innocent young woman. However, reading between the lines, we see that young Moll's true character is not so gullible. For instance, she always keeps part of her finances private. Yeah, so, I mean, she is actually thinking strategically, et cetera, et cetera. She's not this innocent victim who just gets carried along by the circumstances. She has a level of planning, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not what old Moll is presenting us with. How does young Moll live her subjective experience? Okay. So, I mean, we have a situation where clearly events, as is absolutely normal in a first-person narrative, are presented very much from her perspective. But again, reading between the lines, we can see how much this is the case. So, for example, she is finally caught by two shop girls when she is stealing cloth and she's put them under her clothes. And she describes those shop girls as fiery dragons and saucy jades. Yeah? Basically, they are two young women doing their job. Part of the reason why they're such horrible people is that they can't be bribed. So, there is the suggestion from Madam Midnight that they couldn't be bribed with £500 when they're earning something like £3 a year. These, from an objective point of view, are highly moral young women doing their job. And you could easily imagine, I don't know if it's the case, but you could easily imagine a situation where, as has happened, I don't know if it's legal now, but as happened until relatively recently in a lot of places, if something is stolen from a shop, the person working in the shop has to pay for it. Yeah? Or have to pay for part of it. So, I mean, the situation in terms of detaining her and getting her arrested, etc., is absolutely reasonable. But they're described in sort of quite strong language as terrible people. And yet we have the ship's bosun who accepts a bribe from Moll so that she can travel as a passenger rather than a prisoner below deck and gets set free when she gets to America rather than having to do peonage, is described as a courteous and honest gentleman. But this is somebody who is just benefiting corruptly from his position of power. But, so we get very much that subjectivity about the people she's coming in contact with. Moll, in any case, is a boundary blurrer. Do you remember what a boundary blurrer is? Right, so we generally, as human beings, like to think of people and things and ideas and everything in terms of discrete categories, often binary discrete categories, because we have two hands, we like to think of things in terms of binary. So anybody who's in that grey area between two categories is actually very, very interesting for literature because they help us to define the categories, and sort of get us to think about the definitions of categories. So we have the obvious example, not very politically correct, but it is a good example. In Volpone, I was getting excessive compulsive disorder about the microphone being straight. We have the example in Volpone of the three zanies who are a dwarf, a eunuch and a hermaphrodite, who obviously the dwarf from an unreconstructed primitive point of view is not a child or an adult. Obviously dwarves can be adults, but that's from that mindset. And the hermaphrodite and the eunuch do not fit into easy male-female categories again. So those are typical examples, but you can find them throughout literature. And, for example, most of the people in the Canterbury Tales, most of the pilgrims, are in some sense boundary blurrers, etc., etc., etc. So, she is a pauper with a lady's education. And she is quite clearly superior to her context, to her environment, to her surroundings. She's somebody who has a better brain than most of the people who have power over her. But she has no legal way of actually advancing in this society. So, I mean, again, if you were talking about William Langland last year, Langland, as one of this sort of clerical proletariat, was in a similar situation. He could not advance through the church hierarchy, but he was clearly very able in all sorts of ways. And these people are, by the way, very dangerous, because they are likely to be people who instigate revolution and rebellion against the system. But they are also interesting as boundary blowers. So this leaves her with this all-consuming ambition to become a lady, which she to some extent romanticizes as her destiny. So she has this idea that this is her destiny. And since we're seeing things actually from a teleological point of view, from the end of her life as an old woman, this is her destiny because that's what had happened. Now, whether that is what was inevitable in the sense of fate and sense of destiny is a completely different question. But since that is what happened, that is how Old Moll sees this as her destiny of becoming this. Yeah, I mean, I think I don't think it's necessarily a nonconformist position, and there are radically different positions like that. I mean, if you're a Calvinist, everything's decided before you're born, because you're one of the elect and all this type of thing. Whereas most nonconformists in Britain were not Calvinists and wouldn't have that sort of extreme position. That's sort of a more sort of nuanced Lutheran point of view of justification by faith, I think, would be more common than that type of thing. But of course, all of that is being seen through, if you like, the superstition of a woman who has been in those types of circumstances and is surrounded by sources of power which are infinitely more powerful than her. I mean, she's sort of, if you think of it in video game terms, she's trying to find a route through a system where she can easily be crushed in any moment. At the same time, there is this alternative, I mean, if you want to see it in terms of fate, there is this alternative fate of ending up in Newgate. And so you can sort of see these things as competing fates, if you like, or you can see them as ambition versus fate. Part of the irony of the novel is how the two forces, which, I mean, apparently her drive to become a lady is a good thing and the possibility of ending up in Newgate is a bad thing, but often going to Newgate, for example, getting Central America actually has positive consequences, or and her drive to become a lady has ironic consequences as well. And of course that stems from the fact that the whole concept of what a lady is comes from her seeing a prostitute in Colchester and thinking that that was, you know, as a lady of the night or whatever the term might be, that was what a lady looked like, you know, with lots of colourful clothes, etc., etc. But that woman was a prostitute. And so her progress towards being what she considers a lady is actually a progress towards prostitution, which is, of course, ironic. At the same time, Moll has an undeveloped sense of morality. So she takes pride in the accomplishments of her criminal ingenuity. Likes telling people about how clever she was stealing things. Again, that is not a particularly penitent position. But she knows that she is cleverer than the people who are around her, or was cleverer than the people around her. And she only considers repentance when faced with the prospect of death. First in Newgate, and then at the end of her life. So, she has this, if you like, this moral system, slightly Grotian moral system, with the idea that first she has to become a lady. Once she's become a lady, once she's in a position of comfort, then she can worry about repentance. What she needs is time, and it's one of the things she says in Newgate, that The fact that her sentence in Newgate was commuted and she was transported gave her more time to try and become a lady, and then she could have repented again. We just postponed her repentance, if you like. That is not, we have Maslow writing in the 1950s, but that is an idea in a crude sense that goes way back. I mean, we have medieval concepts of that sort of thing. One of the ways of seeing her is this as a sort of slightly animalistic force of nature, dynamic drive towards survival. And the one thing that she really can't do as a character in the story as much as a real person, or as a real fictional person, if you know what I mean, is settle down in comfort and security. And that's one of the things that actually that Virginia Woolf recognized. This character, if this character actually stops in any full limited sense and just becomes comfortable, that is death for her, because her drive is to attain those things. So once those things are attained in her old age, she's basically preparing to die. What is the title of the novel? What does it say inside your book? Not on the outside. What does it say inside? Stop. Okay. There is a subtitle after that, but if we take that part of it. Okay. So, what are the double meanings of fortunes and misfortunes? Well, what can fortune mean? In terms of this being very much a tally, a process of measuring how much money she has at each moment, it is the fortunes of Lord Flanders, the different amounts of money that she has in different stages of her life. What about misfortunes? But it can be, the formal and the obvious sense is it being meaning bad luck, good, okay. But do you know any other meanings of... You haven't read all of the documents, I think. No? A misfortune at this time was an unwanted pregnancy or unwanted children. So, if you like, and we can very much, we can actually do this at a scale, we can measure sums of money, like in assets and liabilities, sums of money, children. And the way that those two things move around into different categories is a lot of what is just propels the story forward. Another way of seeing that would be, do you understand snakes and ladders? Like the Huelalauca, basically. Huelalauca? No? Okay. I have no idea what the Hungarian equivalent is. There is a very simple English game and slightly more complicated Spanish game, much more complicated, which involves you throwing dice and you move along squares, and there are squares which get to ladders which take you up, see, and there are snakes which take you down. That's snakes and ladders. And they're sort of similar, no? I've never actually played it with a longer. So, if you like, you've got the sort of money going up, children going down process of fortunes and misfortunes. What are the resonances of the name Moll Flanders? So, yeah, there were lots of prostitutes coming from Holland and from the Flemish areas, from Flanders, possibly. Any other meanings of Flanders? Flanders cloth at this stage could mean cloth of not very good quality. But a Flanders piece is what probably today we would describe pretty much as an impressionist painting. So there were paintings that from a certain distance looked very nice, landscapes and things. But when you got close, they were sort of quickly painted and not very detailed. And we can very much appreciate that sort of thing today because we've had the impressionists between times. But that was just looked sort of cheap and nasty at this time. So there can be the implications of cheap and nasty in the idea of a Flanders piece. Okay, so what are the literary antecedents of Moll Flanders? Okay. And in a much more direct sense, since we know Alexander Selkirk was somebody who was marooned on an island for several years. So it's basically just taking somebody's story and embellishing it a lot. But yes, okay, so we have the idea of novel as false autobiography. I have four more things. Yeah? Well, we have the idea of romance, yeah, somebody propelled by fate, if you like, spiritual biography, Rhodes biography, and Connie Catcher books. So what's a spiritual biography? Right, so it's the story of the life of a sinner who has an epiphany and therefore repents and tells everybody about how all the bad things they did because they now are good, I think. So there is a relationship with that, and we can think about what the relationship is. What is a Rhodes biography? Also known as a criminal biography, that might make it easier. Yeah, exactly. Right. So the most famous thing is the Newgate Calendar, where you get the story of all the terrible crimes of somebody and their execution. So both of these two categories together are considered improvement literature. They're both things with very heavy, not very subtle, moral lessons to make people better. And it seems that Defoe is being slightly ironic about these two forms. One of the problems with improvement literature is that you can see simultaneously a sort of fascination and a repulsion with criminal ingenuity in Rhodes' biographies. So there is... there seems to be just a little bit too much Protestant or Puritanical enjoyment of all of the bad things that people do. And then you make it acceptable at the end by having them die. And I mean, if you like, it's a little bit like the secret pleasure that we get out of watching something like Richard III being successful and killing lots of people. And then, of course, at the end we have the, you know, Richard gets killed, and so that's all right. So we can, you know, we can feel that we haven't got too much gratuitous pleasure out of it because the person is punished in the end. But that is the sort of structure of these things. What about Connie Catcher or Connie Catcher novels or books? And this is the sort of English equivalent of the picaresque to some extent. One of the important things that we get from that is we see Moll keeping a financial tally of all of the things. There's some of that type of materialism in that, talking about the value of things that have been stolen, etc., in a lot of these short stories, and what has been described as ritualistic stock-taking. So, for example, there are a collection of narratives which are called the Moll or Mary Carlton narratives, which were written in 1663 to 1673, where we have that sort of thing happening. But the difference there is that, apart from the fact that they are just sort of separate short stories, we have a very obvious and intrusive narrator who is showing us, making sure that we have none of the moral lessons have escaped. And so, you know, everybody gets punished in the end, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas that is clearly much more ambiguous and much more subtle in what we get in North Flanders. So, mention again of the sort of narrator that we get from the Canterbury Tales. What other connection did we get with the Canterbury Tales here? Long time ago, does that mean? This is your second time doing the first year, right? In the first year?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So you have an excuse. They didn't have an excuse. The Wife of Bath. Okay? In The Wife of Bath, we get presented with a woman who basically does all of the terrible things that women are told, that the society of the time says that women do, and she says, yes, I do them, and... And that's to some extent what we get with North Flanders. We get somebody who's incredibly vivacious, somebody who's quite attractive in their honesty and their directness and their energy, who basically says, yeah, okay, I did these things. There's a reason for it. There's a reason the way that society is set up, etc. But yeah, I did them. Explain to me why this is bad, sort of thing. And so I think there is quite a close relationship there with that. And there was, if I remember correctly, there was in the 1710s, I'm pretty sure, there was like a theatrical version of The Wife of Bath produced. So it was actually quite in the, I think that is included in my notes about The Beggar's Opera. If anybody's interested in that, I can look it up. So remind me on the forum and I'll look it up. Chaucer continues to be sort of, you know, something that's read and something that's influential in this period, and I see a certain similarity between these two characters.
So would you say that in one
of
subverts
So, I mean, or if you like, it's just being much more realistic, in the sense that, because this, I mean, this deterministic idea that when people do bad things, if they don't repent in time, they get punished for them. And so nobody actually, in the long-term sense, benefits from doing bad things. You know, we all live in a society where, that's absolutely clear that doesn't happen. They've just dropped all the charges. Yesterday they dropped all the charges against Donald Trump, because there's no way of pursuing them. People do bad things and they get away with them completely. Pol Pot died in his bed. Stalin died in his bed. Paquito died in his bed. We do not live in a moral universe. And I think that, and you were saying, well, listen to your Puritan, but somebody who has a Catholic education like somebody who has a Catholic education like Pope would be able to recognize that. Don't assume that because we're saying somebody comes from a Puritan family that they are an extreme Puritan. Yeah? We don't necessarily assume that somebody who is Anglican is some sort of extreme Anglican, if that's possible. Or somebody who is a Roman Catholic is necessarily an extreme Roman Catholic. So don't necessarily equate nonconformists with somebody who that is dominating their life. When we other somebody, we tend to associate them with the extreme version of that. Be careful with that. But I think that's very much part of what's being recognized here. And it's absolutely clear with the rich and the well-to-do and the powerful in the society. And if those people who have much more control over their lives are not punished for doing bad things, then in what type of God-driven or moral universe are poor people punished for doing bad things if rich people are not punished for doing bad things? So I think the social justice side of Defoe is actually much more important. All saying yes, but remember that the stories which you are being fed constantly by all sorts of sources, from the pulpit, from sermons, or from the Newgate calendar, etc., are ultimately stories, and that stories are manipulated so that somebody can sell you a particular idea. You know, this is somebody who's been writing pamphlets, and quite controversial pamphlets, all of his life. He wrote several thousand of them. So, I mean, he knows how propaganda works. And to some extent, it's like saying, well, if you enjoy these types of sort of stories, okay, I will say it in a different sort of way. In many senses, it's much less insidious, something like Semana or Hola or Diez Minutos. Diez Minutos is the same sort of thing? Oh, you don't know. Okay. Well, those sorts of magazines which are just looking at scandalous aspects of lives of famous people. Sorry? Yeah. But in Britain, what we tend to have is tabloids, which will do, you know, apparently, supposedly, very good sports pages and lots of scandal and stuff, and then be selling you very, very right-wing politics, all in the same thing. Whereas if you're just selling fantasy diversions of what this princess has done, or this famous person, who this famous person is sleeping with, or whatever, and that's separate as a magazine about how the rich live and look at what exciting lives they have and blah, 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 that actually is much less insidious than combining that with extreme right-wing politics, as happens with something like The Sun or The Star in Britain. So, and quite a lot, I think, in some American popular newspapers. Again, I'm probably talking much more now about the past, because newspapers are so marginal these days anyway, but that certainly has been the case in the past. So, is this the first novel? Silence. Can we count this as the first novel? The first modern novel. What are the arguments against? That was more of a novella. It wasn't really long enough. I mean, one of our criteria for novels, I think, would be a certain length. But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's part of the process, Incognita, just as Urinoku by Afra Ben is part of the process, or Don Quixote is part of the process. Well, one of the main arguments against would be that it's still pretty episodic. What can we argue against somebody saying, no, it's too episodic to be considered a novel? What could we say to defend North Flanders in that sense? Right, okay. How does she evolve? Okay, so there is that process which in the novel is described as hardening, the hardening of her character, and so there is a certain amount of development in her character, not necessarily in the right direction, and especially from being a child into being a sort of young adult. But it's not a building to one man in the sense that we don't sort of stop when the person becomes the young adult or the first time they get married or whatever. And the character is much more constant after that. But that, to some extent, is quite realistic in the sense that once you've sort of fully mentally developed at the age of 24 or 25, your character does tend to be, I mean, obviously it changes, but it changes much more slowly, much faster between, say, 7 and 25 than it does between 25 and 80, perhaps, or whatever. There is a certain amount of psychological realism in that structure. Also, we're not just following Moll's life with an omniscient narrator. We are following Moll's life through old Moll with clever accounting. And when you think back over your life, you tend to construct your life in terms of anecdotes. There are salient moments there are big spaces in the middle where an awful lot doesn't happen because you're in the same job, the same relationship, whatever. It's not a good thing or a bad thing, it's just that there's less that stands out. And so if you were to sit down and write your life, you would actually find in the circle that you have this series of anecdotes that sort of illustrate each of the periods that you're in. And you may even find a situation where you are imposing a narrative on that process, which you were completely unaware of at the time. But because you're looking at it in hindsight, you want to see it in terms of cause and effect and narrative. It becomes conventional in novel writing afterwards, and it's always wrong to blame somebody for not fulfilling a convention that starts afterwards. But it becomes conventional afterwards to have a teleological development in novels. Yeah, so Tom Jones will develop towards a mature state of being Tom Jones throughout the novel, Tom Jones, etc. But to a large extent, Defoe actually addresses this teleological conception of the novel and rejects it, because what he has is that older version of the person who's telling the story and trying to manipulate us and trying to impose on that story that teleology. So he's almost anticipating what's going to come afterwards and rejecting it by the very structure of having first person narration, old Moll talking about what happened in her previous existence. And of course, most of what she says is made up, because you don't remember conversations, you don't remember details about rooms, almost all of the detail, I mean, it may be a case that she went to America, but almost all of the detail of what happened is something that she has been actually processing and developing and changing in her mind. Modern psychology compares the mind to a Wikipedia page, and it's constantly adds extra details, etc., and those extra details often become much more entrenched than the original first experience. So, I mean, it's like when somebody, you know, I think we've all had the experience of seeing a video or a photo of something in our childhood, and you said, oh, didn't know I knew him at that stage, or I didn't know that was there then, or blah, blah, blah. The stories that we construct are often quite at odds with, and we will all deny things completely when there's no objective evidence. The problem is when you have photos, you suddenly sort of have to re-question your reality. And so, we can use the story to reconstruct that objective reality which Moll is manipulating through her subjective experience and manipulating through her teleological intentions to control the story. How is the novel structured? Another way of saying that, we could also talk about the real life inspiration that I've mentioned and some of those in the notes. How is the novel structured? Right. But I mean, what that could describe a simple series of series of anecdotes that are meant to illustrate a particular story morally or ironically. But that would still be episodic. But there are larger processes at play which link the different episodes of her life. And those basically are three. There is Newgate, the fact that she goes from Newgate to Newgate. And if you like, there is her mother as an even larger process. There is America. And there is Jenny. So the anecdotes are not just isolated events. They do actually link forwards and backwards to things. In a way that is pretty realistic for somebody who basically lives through false identity most of her life. Since she doesn't actually, generally speaking, stay in touch with the same groups of people for any length of time, that episodic nature is realistic, but because she does reconnect with Jemmy, with Madam Midnight, there is the Newgate process, and there is the London is also a major character in that sense, so she's going and coming and going in London. All of those things are relevant. Why are money and clothes so important? It's windy in the kitchen. Okay, so Defoe as this dissenter, as this social justice warrior, etc., is somebody who is against privilege. And all societies are societies in transition, as we all know. But we have this situation where if the society is emerging from its medieval and Renaissance context, where basically the rich are considered a different species, by this stage, to a large extent, the gentry are considered a different species, you can hugely subvert those ideas if you say somebody who, by pure chance, happens to have been able to overhear or receive to some extent the education of a lady, even though she comes from the criminal class and was an orphan who was abandoned from Newgate, etc., she is, if all that it takes for her to be a lady is the right clothes and a bit of money, then there's not actually that huge or fundamental difference between the different types of humanity. From a society that basically says the only real human beings are aristocratic men, we are being presented with the idea that actually humanity is a much wider thing than just this particular group of people who have been the focus of romance until this point in time. And so that is, that is, if you like, the whole story of Moll Flanders is when she's in a situation of getting enough money, having enough money and being able to wear the clothes that she needs, she can easily pass herself off as a lady, and she can get into all sorts of situations where she is able to control people because they simply see her clothes, etc. Is there anything we've seen in literature that this could be compared to so far? Yes. Right. I mean, there is this medieval, in the sartorial laws, there is a medieval recognition that there is this danger, that, that's why poor people are not allowed to wear the clothes of rich people unless they have a special license because they're actors, etc. It seems completely bizarre to us, but it actually makes sense from that point of view. I was thinking more recently, do you remember that there is a point where petulance gets some prostitutes to dress up as members of the Rochefort ladies and ask, you know, arrive in a carriage and ask for him to make himself look. That there is again that idea that you can just you know, hire some prostitutes to dress up as ladies and they will pass off as ladies. That is, if you like, in the case of because Petulance is such a ridiculous character, probably nobody would actually believe that situation, whereas clearly Mont Flanders is meant to be believable in this situation. Okay. Blah blah blah. So I mean, I did have the final question just here. Is Moll immoral? And I think it's still a bit of an open question. It depends whose morals. Does she fulfill the morals that she sets for herself? I think largely she does. Is she any worse than all of the men that we come across in this story? Not. Are we being presented with literature that has two categories of people, a binary process of saints and sinners? No, because that's not what happens in reality. The answer is moral, is sort of, like all of us. She does what she has to do, and she doesn't actually intentionally hurt anybody if, you know, without a good cause. So perhaps, who knows, what is moral? Moral tends to be something that is imposed from above on everybody else, and often with the people above not actually fulfilling the morals that they're imposing on everybody else. So again, I don't think that last statement would be something that Daniel Defoe would have any great difficulty with. I think he would probably say yes, exactly, to that. So, this is the sort of society we live in, is what he's saying. And an intelligent woman might negotiate it in this way if she was put in the circumstances. I think. I don't know. Anyway, at the end of the notes, I happen to find, just in case I ran out of time, a series of questions about Moll Flanders that I found on the internet. So you will be able to look at those and think if they're interesting or not. Right, okay, well, good to have contact with you, Manuel. I hope you are having a good life. We will continue next week with Elegy in an English Churchyard. Okay, bye. Thomas Gray. Just that? That's the